Okay, it's official time, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. We're going to be in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, for those of you who would like to go ahead and turn there. Thanks for coming to this session. I've given you a handout, not because I'm going to follow it slavishly necessarily, but because I do have a tendency to, once I get on topic, to just kind of go everywhere preaching the word. And so if there's anything I forget to say, it'll be there. And if you're wanting to write something down and you're thinking, I wanted to get that, you know, really good nugget down, like I'm going to throw out some nuggets, maybe, it'll probably already be there, just in case. And hope that it will be of value to you. I don't know what you might have been expecting in coming to this particular session. My guess is, though, I'm looking around the room, and it looks maybe a little more than half of you, perhaps, I'm just looking around just to be sure, are baby boomers. Boomers, raise your hands. Okay, some of you who are willing to acknowledge that you're boomers. Okay, all right. Now, when you look at this text, for everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven.
Change.
That's right. That's right. That reminds me of how many Church of Christ elders does it take to change a light bulb? You know, change! What do you mean? Change! We're not going to change right now. No, I'm thinking of Pete Seeger and his song, who was popularized by the Byrds in the 1960s. Come on, we can sing it, guys. Come on. To everything turn. There is a... I mean, man, you guys are even harmonizing. I mean, this is a Church of Christ group singing a Pete Seeger song. Wow, that's great. Well, it's a great text, isn't it? You know, but here's part of the problem. I don't know about you guys, but I try to look back on the number of times I've heard this text. And of all the times I've heard them, most of the time, it has been a funeral. Right? Okay. There are some funeral passages in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Or in Ecclesiastes, you know, better the day of one's death than the day of one's birth, better to go into the house of mourning than in the house of feasting, and that sort of thing, because, yeah, there is something about that. I remember reading Patrick Morley several years ago in his book, Man in the Mirror, where he said a real important point came in his life when he started thinking about who would be at his funeral and what reason they would have either to mourn or celebrate his passing. And so he began to sort of live with that in mind. And there's value in that. I mean, you got to go there. That is an important piece of understanding. You might want to grab an outline as you're coming in. Good. But this text really does not address death fundamentally. In fact, it's talking more about a rhythm of life and actually how to engage it. And there's a real important philosophical balance that is expressed in this text. Now, for those of you who might be following the outline, I've indicated there at the top that there is the poem, and then there's the theological reflection on the poem. So let's begin by just reading the poem. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away. A time to tear, and a time to sow. A time to keep silence, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. For me, just the reading of the poem moves my soul to say, so it's okay. Whatever I'm experiencing, there's some inherent good in that experience. if I will look for it. Maybe not inherent, but at least instrumental good in that experience. But then he gives the theological commentary. By the way, outlines, did you get an outline coming in? Okay, good. I think there's just a few left. Good. Super. There's the theological commentary on the poem. That picks up in verse 9. So here we go with that. What gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the busyness that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he's put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, and that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceived that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. It's a really, really meaningful text. Well, all right. What I've tried to do in this lesson, and there is a sequence to what I'm doing here, and I want you to see that sequence. First, I want us to look at the themes that are tucked into the poem. Because there are these themes. The first theme that emerges is what is said right there at the beginning, in the very first verse. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, which I've just summarized. There's a time for everything. Time for everything. Time to be born, time to die, time to plant, a time to pluck up. You've got these 14 balanced pairs, what I call polarities. And a polarity, it's important to draw this distinction. A polarity and polarization should not be thought of in the same way. A polarity just means that there are two legitimate realities that are sort of on opposite sides of the coin. Polarization can occur when we start emphasizing one end of the polarity over another and we forget the balance. That can be a kind of polarization. You know, that's when polarity's gone to seed, right? But these are just 14 balanced pairs, what we would call polarities. And to see that, you know, they're all good. There's nothing wrong with dying. There's nothing wrong with plucking. There's nothing wrong with healing. There's nothing wrong with building up. But on the other hand, there's nothing wrong with breaking down, killing, planting, being born in Kohelet and his expression of these experiences. That each of them has its time. And that time is good. Now, I don't know about you, but my guess would be that you've probably got a few of these that are especially poignant for you. You know, there's some of them that are that way for me. You know, when I go down through here, one of them that I really, you know, that I tend to think a lot about, time to weep and a time to laugh. You know, and how important it can be to think in that way. And I remember when I graduated from Lipscomb back in 1982, summer of 1982, one of my teachers just came bounding down the steps one day, and I was like, you know, a few weeks away from graduation, had no idea where I was going to go. And my teacher, he came bounding down the steps, and he said, who would like to go to an internship over at the Homewood Church in Birmingham, Alabama this summer? Just kind of standing around with my friends, and I said, well, I guess I would. He said, well, they got this preacher over there. He's a really great guy. He's a real motivator. He's kind of he loves Iowa North, and he wears all the big red jackets and the white pants, and he's a great motivator, a wonderful man, a fellow named Wayne Kilpatrick. And I said, oh, well, okay, that'll be fine. So I followed Rubel Shelley up the steps. He was the one who set it up for me, and Rubel called and said, hey, I got this guy coming this weekend. He's going to talk to you. And so I went and did this internship at the Homewood Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Now, you have to understand that in my undergraduate years, I was kind of geeky. You know, I mean, you've seen the images of the typical Bible major at the old Christian colleges, the satchel toters, and the ones who, when they went to class, literally took their libraries with them. You know, I was sort of that guy.
And I had practical bones in my body, but I also loved conjugating Greek verbs. And when he came bounding down the steps and said, "Who wants to go to Birmingham, Alabama, to the Homewood Church of Christ?" I knew that I was not going to be conjugating Greek verbs that summer. And when I went upstairs and he told me all about it, I knew I wasn't going to. Well, I went there and I did a whole lot of things. I met my wife, met the woman who eventually became my wife, which is another really, really neat story. I won't get into that because I won't be able to stop telling a little bit about that story. But I remember I went there, and the church, the Homewood Church, at the time was located on Old Oxmoor Road, the Old Oxmoor Road, that little stretch for those of you who know anything about Birmingham. And it was located directly across the street from Our Lady of Sorrows Catholic Church. Okay? And it's true, Jesus is Man of Sorrows, right? Okay? And that's appropriate. But Wayne used to say, "We are the Church of the Man of Joy, located across the street from Our Lady of Sorrows." And boy, I mean, that church just reflected everything that was a part of that. And part of my responsibility was to arrange for the hot air balloons and the moonwalks during VBS and the great big fire trucks. You know, I was the intern, so I had to do all of that. Because there was just something about laughter that made that church what it was. Now, at the same time, they used to love to sing the song, "Sometimes we laugh together, sometimes we cry." You know, we're part of the family. And there was that identification. But weeping and laughing become important. One of the neatest experiences I had once when I went to speak at a church over in East Tennessee, one of my colleagues was preaching at a church over there out in Blount County. Which, if you know anything about the area of East Tennessee, you know, you've got Knoxville, but it has several counties that border Knox County that form the metropolitan area. And we were there for a little over 20 years. And part of my time was teaching at Johnson University. One of my colleagues was there preaching for this church, Blount Christian Church. And so I walk into the building, and I'm just struck by the first thing I see on the wall is this huge mural of the laughing Jesus. Some of you may have seen it, but it just hits you squarely. I mean, the wall is huge. I mean, it's bigger than this one. Back, and it has a picture of Jesus. Of course, he's sort of the long-haired, you know, typical picture. All right, I get that. There's, you know, probably needed to be done differently in that respect. But there's a picture of the laughing, where he's just rearing back with glistening bright eyes and a great big smile on his face, just laughing uproariously. And I think, wow, there's so much about Jesus that we don't see that. We don't see the guy who goes to the wedding and enjoys it. We don't see the guy who's both weeping, the man of sorrows, Lazarus, and laughing. It's time to mourn and a time to dance. I like to listen to Pandora solo piano radio when I get to my office. It literally is a brain switch for me. That's not an exaggeration to say it. It's a brain switch for me that I concentrate. I mean, it's hard for me not to concentrate when that kind of music is going on. But sometimes I get tired of concentrating. Much study is a weariness of the flesh. And so I'll close my door and turn on different music and do a little Christian choreography. Listening to Cotton Eye Joe or Orange Blossom Special or something like that, because I spent enough time in the mountains there in East Tennessee that I've got a little of that Irish music that I just really like. I love the fact that this text captures so much of that balance. There's a time to mourn, and there's a time to dance. And then there's time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together, time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. Then there's this a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sew together. Probably something about the mourning and repentance of the experience of those who were for whom this text would be very, very important, of the tearing of the clothes in anguish over one sin or perhaps over the situation one might be facing, and then the sewing back together of the same garment. Keep silent, speak, time for love, time for hate, time for war, and time for peace.
Now that's the time for everything. And that's this first theme that emerges from the text. Everything has its time. But then secondly, that builds out of that, God makes everything beautiful in its time. God makes everything beautiful in its time. Beautiful can also be translated suitable or good, that there is an inherent, if not inherent, then at least instrumental good in each of these experiences. And the writer doesn't give any preference to either end of any polarity. And he helps us to see what is undesirable in one occasion is preferable for another. Dancing is not appropriate for mourning, nor weeping at celebrations. Everything has its appropriate place, and it's beautiful, and it's good in its time. I remember several years ago, I used to love a song that I forget which group it was popularized by. It's a Christian song. In his time, he makes all things beautiful in his time. And it expresses this, that each of these experiences has a kind of beauty to it. I've done a lot of funerals in my ministry. When you're a preacher, you know, if somebody hasn't told you yet, especially those of you who are younger and preparing for ministry, you know you have to have the one suit that is your marrying and burying suit. And because you do both of those experiences, and there's probably nothing in Scripture that says an important aspect of a minister's work is to do weddings and funerals, okay? But the being able to do that, the privilege that American culture gives ministers to be a part of those events is really, really important. And I've been a part of situations where I've been in those funerals and have begun to see the beauty that's a part of an occasion like that, even. To where you sit, where you literally do celebrate the life and the legacy of the person who has passed. And one of my regular practices when I would be in a pastoral role with that situation is bring the whole family together and ask them this question: help me to understand the most blessed memories and the most significant deposits that this person has made in your life. Just pause. It's a pregnant pause. All it takes is one person beginning it. And I'm sitting there and I'm writing. And they know I'm writing to build a tribute that I usually put in written form and will present it to the family, a tribute to this person. And to be able to see, there's beauty in that. Of being able to recognize that this person lived a good life. And because they did, there's reason to celebrate, and to be able to carry on somewhat of a legacy there. There's an outline right there.
All right.
Great. So he makes everything beautiful in its time. But then there is this statement that God gives us an unsatisfiable curiosity about this process. The way the one translation puts it, and I've given it there in the outline, God makes everything happen at the right time, yet none of us can fully understand all that he has done. And he puts questions in our minds about the past and the future. Or there was another translation. God never gives us the satisfaction of fully understanding what he does. I was just talking with a friend. We had lunch. And I was sitting talking with him. And how many of you have ever taken the StrengthsFinder, the Clifton StrengthsFinder? You know what I'm talking about? It's an incredible profile. It's really, really fine. And I have a friend who's just gone through the Gallup certification process to be a coach with that. And he said, Carlos, I want you to take it. And I said, well, you know, I think I've already taken it. No, he said, you haven't taken this one. He said, you really need to take the long one. I need to get all 34 of your read on all 34 of them. I said, okay, that's great. I'll be happy to do that. So I did. And so he sat down with me. He says, we'll start. Let's see, we're going to pick up. And we're planning to pick up several months from now after he goes through his list of people that he's have said, hey, walk me through it. And if you know, you walk through that, you know you have your top five. And there's no real ranking in the top five, right? I mean, they're all important, and they all appear kind of simultaneously and concurrently, very strongly in your life. It's kind of this, you know, there's this symbiosis that they have with each other. Well, I when he looked at mine, he said, Carlos, I now understand why contentment is not in your
He says it's not even in your DNA. He said it doesn't even appear on your radar. And I said, you're right. But I said, I've never really seen it as a lack of contentment. But I'm always thinking of the next thing. He says, well, the reason for that is because futurist is right at the top. He says, you're always thinking about the future. You're always thinking about, he said, you thrive well in the gig economy to where it's just this gig, that gig. And I said, well, I kind of do, but I love stability too. He says, right, adventure with security. I said, where'd you get that one? He said, this one right here. And he showed me how all of that was working. And that was one of the, I was working on this text at the time when we were talking about it, and it made me think, yeah, that's my way of experiencing the fact that I have this insatiable curiosity about the way things are supposed to work out in God's economy in my life, right? And I always want to know. But each of us has our own struggle with that. For some, it's not the struggle of what lies ahead. It's the struggle of why did this happen? Or what if I had been able to do this or this or this? And to be able to ask that constant what if question. But we can't satisfy that. But what's interesting, I think this is one of the things the text says. God says you can't satisfy that interest, but He wants you to try. Because as you try to engage that quest, there's something about the nature of life lived in fear of God that becomes clearer to us. The more we try to have what God alone has in that respect, in terms of his capacity to see and understand it all, the more we try to get there, the more we understand we deeply need him. And so that's part of the reason why he's given us this. One of the statements I have there under number three again, human beings are caught between self-transcendence, that is, we can sit back and think about our existence, and stifling ignorance. We are both in time and out of time. And that's what this statement underscores. But then number four, again, we're in the themes of this text. God gives us the capacity and the responsibility to enjoy our slice of life. That even though there is something innate in human existence that says, there's a lot about life you're never going to be able to figure out, and it will be frustrating for you. But then it also says, however, you do need to have the capacity to be content, to be happy, and to enjoy what you have in front of you. That's in verses 12 and 13. Let's read that again, where he says, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, and also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. God's gift to man. I love the way Dietrich Bonhoeffer put it. This is one just one little snippet from him that is illustrative of this principle. I've got it right there at the bottom of the page. He says, to put it plainly, for a man in his wife's arms to be hankering after the other world is, in mild terms, a piece of bad taste and not God's will. We ought to find and love God in what he actually gives us, if it pleases him to allow us to enjoy some overwhelmingly earthly happiness. We must not try to be more pious than God himself. For everything there is a season. I love that. I love that. How many of you have seen the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding? Yeah, right. Isn't it great? And one of the things about that movie that I really, really like is they're trying to come to terms with the fact and live into this whole thing that life is festive. Did you get that sense when you watch that movie that for that family, life is always festive and it's good, and that they appreciate and love those experiences, whether it's trying to understand what is a bund
a bun. It's a cake. A cake. Yeah. Or using Windex for every possible cleaning experience, or, you know, or the fact that, and I just loved these scenes in the movie where the bride-to-be, you know, and all the women were with her upstairs. And it's like, every place she went, the whole group was just following her around and giving her constant advice on what was going on and how stressful, but at the same time meaningful, and how tear-filled, but at the same time happy that it was. And you come away from something like that and you're thinking, wow, this is really, really good. But on the other hand, you can have the opposite of that. Ann and I were late on the train with West Wing. Okay? And by the way, if you haven't binge-watched West Wing, you're missing the best binge-watching there is around. It's fabulous. I mean, it's really, really good. In my opinion, here's what it did for me. It redeemed, in a very real sense, what I've sort of always known but never had the experience. I've never been a public servant. Now, I've had a lot of friends who've served in governmental circles. And they've told me, Carlos, you wouldn't believe. He said, you hear the news and you think all these people are connivers and manipulators and, you know, conspiracy people, you know. He says, no, they're not. This one guy who's talking to me, he says, they're not. He says, some of the finest people on the planet really get into public service because they're trying to make a difference. And they're really trying to be good, honest people in getting it done. West Wing really helped me to see that. That with all the imperfection that was going on, you had these people who were really trying to make a difference. But here's something about it that also struck me. For those of you who've watched it, you know exactly what I'm talking about. These people have no life apart from the West Wing. There's nothing. I mean, there really isn't. They have no margin whatsoever. You know, and it's constantly picturing, you know, how they'll put the little captions on the screen. You know, the day ends, 11:55 p.m. It picks up again, and they're in the office at 5 in the morning. And they've read all the reports about everything that's going on, and they're ready to engage the day. And I'm thinking, where's the margin here? And then you have people like Josh Lyman, you know, the character Josh Lyman, who just never seems to be able to engage a real meaningful human relationship. Even when he's got one just constantly staring him in the face with Donna. But for Donna, the only real relationship there is constantly instrumental on his part. And it seems like every time, you know, she was his assistant, and it seems like he can't get beyond this situation, that when he reaches a spot where he doesn't know what to do, the first thing that comes out of his mouth is, Donna! And he's just hollering and screaming, and Donna runs, and she tries to take care of what's going on, even at a point where she has exceeded him, really, professionally in a lot of ways, and her intuition and capacity is greater. And it's a perfect expression of people who have never understood or realized what it is like to enjoy the moment and to be able to appreciate and love going to a picnic or just sitting down and enjoying incredibly good Eat the Fat Memphis barbecue. Yeah. Or to just have the experience of going to Malibu Seafood and just go there and chomp down on those French fries and fried fat fish and just love it. And then get home or get back to your room at night and feel that in your stomach and can't wait till you get up in the morning and John Mulliken sends me the text and says, we're running. And so we did. I ran farther than he did. He just ran faster than I did. Don't tell John, but he was so gracious when he kept up with my pace. I said, John, you can run your pace. I mean, you know, Navy guy, you know, nuclear ship guy, you know, just perfect John Mulliken guy. And I'm thinking he could outrun me anytime he wants to, but no, he didn't. He just ran beside me, and we had a good run. And to just be able to enjoy that moment. And that is good. Somebody told me here, I think it was just yesterday, and I put it on my Facebook, somebody described Pepperdine Lectures as summer camp for preachers. It was great. It's not just preachers. I get that. There are more than preachers here. But I have to admit, it is like summer camp. I mean, it really is. I have to tell you, I've not gone to one class yet. The entire time I've been here. And I don't know that I will. I can stream them, you know, or I can go and I can get the recording or whatever, and I can be selective. I can't stop my conversations with my buddies. It's been 2012 since I've been here, you know, and so I'm thinking, wow, it's so nice to be able to see you. You know, you're still married? Yeah, yeah, she's still staying with me. That's good, that's good. Let's think a little one-upsmanship. Tell me a story about your church, and I'll tell you a better one about mine. And, you know, that's just the preacher stuff that goes on. But it's just great. Because for me, this is one of the, when I'm thinking, this is beautiful, this is great. I'm enjoying the fat, you know, and enjoying life. And then Ann calls me, my wife, down in Memphis. And she's jealous. She would love to be here in Malibu. And she says, Carlos, you've got to send me a video. Just take me a panoramic video. Stand at the top there where you can see that track underneath you and see the view of the blue Pacific that you talk about all the time in your sermon illustrations. I tried to do it, and my phone wouldn't focus. You know how you try to do that sometimes? And no matter how you put the focus setting, it kind of goes back and forth, and it blurs, and it tightens, and it blurs, and it tightens. Couldn't do it. She was so disappointed. But I think of how wonderful it was that no matter where she is and where I am, all we have to do is talk, and it's as if we're sharing the experience. Because she's my wife. She's my partner. And I'm spoiled rotten. I tell people that all the time. She's Wonder Wife Supermom. And I'm spoiled. It's wonderful, isn't it? Or to be able to just talk with my daughter yesterday, my oldest daughter, 28 years old, just got married in November, which was a great event. It was wonderful. It was almost as exciting and eventful as my big fat Greek wedding. It was a big, fat, expensive wedding. You know how much wedding venues cost these days? My stars, for 12 hours use of a room, thousands of dollars, I think. I need to get into that business, you know. You know, but to be able to talk to her, buying her first car. And I get to be dad. And so she calls me up. She says, okay, Dad, I've done my research. And I said, great. Tell me what questions you were raising in your research. And she told me. And dads, you probably know this feeling, you know, that you have on occasion where just listening to them go through that process and talk to you about it, you're just swelling with pride inside. And you're thinking, she knows how to do this. She's raising the right questions. And she said, okay, now after the research, Dad, I've landed on three possibilities, and I'm going to give them to you in 1-2-3 fashion. I said, yeah. Sweetheart, that's great. I mean, you landed on three good ones. You really, really did. And she said, now let me tell you the questions that I'm going to raise and the stuff I'm going to give to the broker, because I talked her into going with a broker. You know, if you're a car dealer, car salesman, I'm sorry. But I talked with her about going to a broker and how important that is, and just, you know, get that guy. He's got a bigger haystack to get the needle you're wanting, and he knows how to do that. And she said, okay, here are the questions I'm going to raise with the broker. Can you think of anything else? And I said, sweetie, you got more questions than I would raise. That's just great. Now, I know that sounds kind of strange, but that was one of these moments for me. Are you following me there? It was just one of those moments where I was just sitting there enjoying the fruit of everything her mother taught her. And to experience the benefit of her having had the supermom and Wonder Wife and have what little impact I was able to have in that direction. So that's good. But then number five, and I got to hurry here because we've got some applications I want to. God shows his perfect rhythm of human events so that we'll fear him. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it or anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. If you see the notes I've given you there, I'm going to run through these pretty quickly. Acceptance of the human limitation necessarily precedes the awe of God. Do you see that? It necessarily precedes it. God always does what is needed when it's needed. And when we try to override this, it leads to regret that we did not wait for him to work. You ever experienced that? Boy, I have. I was thinking, it would have been so much better if I just waited instead of pushed. When we are patient with him, though, we're led to the holy, wow, Both time and space lack the stability to ensure purposeful existence in themselves. The enduring posture can only be found by trusting God's timing. But then there's another theme from this text, and that's the last one I've listed there, number 6. He patiently repeats things until they're learned. Look in verse 15. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. And this principle is true in the micro sense of our individual lives and in the macro sense of human history. I think that's true. Often, the greatest capacity for good is housed in the strongest propensity for hubris and impatience. You see that? And do you see what I'm saying? Do you understand that? That sometimes the greatest capacity for God to work through someone or some group or some institution or whatever it is housed in people and in institutions who have the greatest propensity for hubris and impatience. Another way of saying that sometimes is the greatest things that God can do are sometimes housed in the people whose talents, whose capacities, whose whatever they've got in life not only gives them what the sort of raw material that God can use and just hone and shape and just make a huge, huge difference, but those people, those institutions, those organizations, those groups are also the ones who have the greatest temptation for hubris and impatience. And much of the good that God would want to do in one life, one church, one country, is never experienced because we fail the tests, plural, wherein He seeks to develop our readiness for His timing. When this happens, God rewinds the clock, places us back in the rhythm until we become what He can use in the time He chooses. Until we get it, He just repeats the cycle over and over again. What are some lessons? Here's some lessons. And I'm going to spend most of my time on the first one because that's what we'll get to when we talk about some major applications here. As we've looked at the themes, what are some lessons we can gather from it? The first one that I'll talk about here is adjusting to the rhythm. Adjusting to the rhythm. Going back to this notion that He's made everything beautiful in His own time. And I've got there a quote from Elton Trueblood in a conversation with John Savage. Now, this was not my conversation with Elton Trueblood, the great Christian philosopher. I've never known him, never had a conversation with him. I did a training once under a fellow named John Savage. I do a lot of church consulting. My early mentor and trainer and teacher in that was a man named John Savage, who was among the United Methodists. Probably, I have to be honest, next to Lyle Schaller, I would probably put John Savage right there in the list of the grandfathers of church consulting, church leaders. Incredible. I took like 7 trainings under John Savage. Savage has a training that he does on life transitions that was really, really good. And one of the key stories that he tells in that is when he had an opportunity once to talk with Dr. Elton Trueblood, the great Christian philosopher. And just in the conversation, he said, "Dr. Trueblood, I'd just be curious as to how you'd respond to this question. If you could give just one principle that you think is important for living a meaningful Christian existence, what might it be?" And he expected some kind of deep, profound kind of observation that was couched in all kinds of convoluted terminology and about supra-sublapsarianism or something like that. It wasn't that. Without hesitation, Trueblood said, "And?" "And." Savage said, "Okay." "And," he said. "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, life is both joy and sorrow, pain and pleasure, good and evil," and he went through a number of polarities. Okay. He says the unhappiest people and the most maladjusted people and the most ineffective churches and Christians I know are people who either think
that most of life is on the negative end of polarities and live and act as if that's the case. Or those who expect life and Christian existence to constantly be on the positive end of the polarities and they get frustrated when it's not, or they live some kind of Pollyannish, weak and shallow existence that it is when it isn't. He says, the most effective people I know in life and in ministry are those who have learned how to live in the and. Thus the title of my presentation, or the subtitle of it, of learning how to live in the and. To be able to experience the rhythm of all of those things. And remember, if you see there in the points I've given you, these are polarities. They're not extremes. Extremes happen when we overemphasize one end of the polarity. No particular end of a polarity is a problem that has to be fixed, but a reality that has to be set to its appropriate rhythm. And for us to be able to appreciate the balance and to kind of see it like inhale and exhale, inhale and exhale, inhale and exhale. You inhale all the time, you know, you hyperventilate. You exhale all the time, you know, well, you can't. There has to be that kind of inhale, exhale. Breathe it in. Push it out. Breathe it in and push it out. And then for us to be able to engage the opportunities and to realize they are, number two, as I've said it, the engagement is not only in the acceptance of what comes, but the choice to actually initiate each polarity at its appropriate time. Don't just accept it, but realize it's time to shift the balance. It's time to actually initiate something. And an example of that is that silence is not golden when the rights of the oppressed are at stake. And there comes the time for advocacy to where we say, this far, no farther. There's a powerless group of people, there's a powerless entity here that cannot speak for itself. They have no voice. And they need someone who actually has a voice to be able to speak for them and to empower them to be able to speak for themselves. And that's just one example of many. Don't just accept what comes, but actually realize you've got to engage the opportunities and then to endure the uncertainties that come alongside that. And to realize some things get settled and some things don't. And to enjoy the ongoing and to embrace the everlasting God in the midst of that. Now, what are some applications? Some applications. There on the next last page, what I've done is I've added a few polarities. And I've talked about the value of living in the and. Think about these polarities with me for just a moment. And as I'm reading down through them, make a check beside those that you think are especially poignant for you right now. One would be individuality and community, right? We're at a time that, in my opinion, is kind of overemphasizing community at the expense of individuality, because for a long time we emphasized individuality at the expense of community. Yeah, but there's both. Cooperation and thoughtful dissent. Quiet acquiescence and righteous anger. Peacekeeping and actually engaging the hard work of peacemaking. Submission and resistance. Praise and criticism. Contemporary and timeless. Tolerance and discipline. Faith and doubt. Status quo. Challenge, consensus, and principle-centered direction, where someone stands up and said, here we go, follow me, let's do this, no choice. Certainty, uncertainty, reflection, and action, confession, and repentance, grace and forgiveness, deep, shallow, heavy, light, strain, relaxation. To everything, turn, turn, turn. They're all there. But then, let me also, and if you guys
I understand if you need to get up and leave. I do, because we're right at 3:15. But if you'll give me two or three more minutes, let me try to finish this little piece, because I think, to me, this is a helpful piece in our time. True moderation in the face of polarization in our country and in our churches. A polarity, again, is simply the existence of a balanced pair of realities. Polarization occurs when we lose our balance and the capacity to appreciate the and appreciating the virtue on each end. In other words, we go to extremes. Murray Bowen's theory of societal regression suggests that in periods of widespread cultural uncertainty, societies become increasingly polarized, evidenced by increases in divorce and litigation and racial tension and drug abuse and bankruptcy and moral license and crime and violence and terrorism. And in general, the emotional processes of all individuals and families and institutions is impaired. And even the more mature members of society are less intentional in their actions, creating a state of recurring incivility and stressful conditions for leaders. And it's especially during times like this that we are vulnerable to any brand of certainty. Any brand of it. And so an example is the proportion today of landslide counties in presidential elections. Please don't hear this as partisan, because it's not. It's an observation of political science. Landslide counties are those where a candidate wins by a margin of 20% or more. Political scientist Bill Bishop reveals landslide counties have increased by 300% since the 1970s. In 1992, 38% of voters lived in landslide counties. In 2012, that grew to 50%. In 2016, it was a whopping 60% of the electorate. One implication is that we increasingly live, experience, and surround ourselves with media and people that reinforce our beliefs rather than challenge them. We often forsake diversity for an overwhelming sameness with a few token outliers. We often choose the same feedback loop of hearing our own thoughts of what is right or wrong, reflected in our choice of watching Fox News or NBC, reading the Wall Street Journal or the New Yorker, or listening to NPR or talk radio. So people in our culture increasingly surround themselves with groups and media who reinforce what they already believe. This is even more complicated in the church, because religion is an emotionally charged subject, and people typically surround the most meaningful and worthwhile areas of their lives with tripwires and alarms. Thus, church folks, like most others in America, select information that reinforces their current beliefs, but are especially protective of their religious convictions and wire them with reactionary alarms. It's time to recalibrate and practice moderation. There are moderates who are called that because they're not activists and may in fact be too uninformed or insecure to make a decision. That's not the moderation I suggest. Then there are moderates who are called that because sometimes they wind up on the right and sometimes on the left and in some cases in between. They go where their own reason dictates, often disregarding repercussions and enduring exclusion and accusations from both sides. Moderation is not middling or wishy-washy, but is an insistence to be unmoved by political pressure and engage oneself and others in fruitful investigation and dialogue. True moderation requires courage and sometimes stubborn determination not to be polarized. In the end, a moderate says calmly but firmly, "Here I stand, and here is why." They stand with clarity and with whatever virtue their stand requires, and there is this need for us to hold convictions and live respectfully in the midst of our diversity, and one discipline that helps us to do that is knowing how to live in the and. And to be able to traverse there confidently and not to press for clarity when ambiguity is the call of the day, and not to dwell in ambiguity when certainty is the call of the day. And not to be so incrementalist and gradualistic that we fail to recognize it's time for change. But on the other hand, not to be so frustrated and ill-willed about things that we're constantly pushing for change before it's time. And then a final application that I'll do here and then we'll leave. The same thing is expressed in our churches. What's often referred to as polarity management, that affirms that not all problems can or should be solved. But in a polarity, both solutions are desirable with a flexible movement or shift in emphasis. Thus, the problem should be managed versus solved. And that can be with our churches enjoying the present and envisioning the future. Appreciative inquiry, gratefully celebrating strengths, and diagnostic evaluation, facing hard reality. Change and stability, contemporary and traditional, small group and large group, stability and change, intergenerational and age-segregated, unity and diversity. There is so much treasure in this text of learning how to live in the end. And I close by reading the poem once again. Hear it again. For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. If you have it in front of you, you can say it with me. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. Everything beautiful in its time. Thank you for being here. Glad that I could share this with you.